You're listening to the McKinsey Podcast, featuring wide-ranging conversations on the issues that matter in business and management.
Hello, and welcome to the McKinsey Podcast. I'm Diane Brady. During the COVID-19 pandemic, few industries have been harder hit than airlines. And as we recover, few will have more challenges getting back to normal. Joining me are two McKinsey partners who've been working on these issues for years and are tracking them. Alex Dichter is a senior partner in London who leads McKinsey's travel practice. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
Good, thanks. And Robin Riedel is a partner in McKinsey's aerospace and defense practice who leads advanced air mobility for the McKinsey Center for Future Mobility out of San Francisco. Robin, welcome.
Thank you, Diane.
So, Alex, let's start with you. Give us some sense of the current state of air travel.
Well, unfortunately, Diane, in many parts of the world, we're still at not zero, but virtually zero. It's been an interesting evolution over the course of the last 8 months. I think most of the world's sort of travel went to almost nothing in April and May. At one point, we were running at about minus 95% if we measured traffic in 2020 compared to traffic in 2019 during the same period. Obviously, some parts of the world have gone back to some degree of normalcy. If we were to look at air travel in mainland China, for instance, where the virus has been well contained, domestic travel is near normal. New Zealand and Australia, at least internally, have gone back to something that starts to look and feel like normal. The U.S., despite very high case growth, does have domestic traffic, some degree of it. But for virtually every other part of the world, what's stopping international travel and to some extent domestic travel are the wide array of restrictions associated with travel. Everybody wants to go on vacation. Everybody wants to go see their friends and family. But if you have to get tested and quarantine on the way back, and in some cases face uncertain changes to those restrictions, it starts to look like a daunting task. And that has kept international travel to a near minimum. In fact, one of the only reasons that we see a reasonable number of long-haul flights still in place is that cargo demand is relatively strong.
This is already an industry that has felt vulnerable for years. This degree of disruption for this long, what is the economic fallout? Will few survive?
Oh, it's an excellent question, Diane. And I think just to put it into numbers, I mean, just for last year, 2020, the estimated impact on airlines is about a $370 billion revenue loss versus 2019. So it's a massive hole that the industry is in. And that's just the airlines, right? You have a much more supply chain to that and other sectors or subsectors. And so, for example, it's an airport, you know, the estimated loss for last year is another $110 billion. And so you add all of that together, you're getting close to, you know, half a trillion of losses across the airline or air travel industries. And so that has impact to the companies on the one hand, but also to the employees on the other. And so in many countries, we've seen airlines reducing their staff numbers and stopping hiring. And so we've seen, pilots, flight attendants, mechanics, and, all kinds of headquarter workers lose their jobs over this crisis and with an unclear path to come back. And so the question of how many airlines will survive or will they, to a large degree, will depend on, some of the government support that is out there and then what the recovery really will look like and whether we will see a significant jump back to pre-COVID levels this year, or whether it will take until 22, 23, or even 24 before we'll see travelers and revenue come back.
Not to put you both in soothsayer camps, but when we talk about recovery, Alex, can you give us some sense of when you look around the corner as to what normalcy will look like?
Sure. I mean, predicting the future is always a dangerous game. I think there are two fundamental axes here. One is the degree to which the world recovers from the economic fallout associated with COVID, and two is the speed at which we put the virus functionally behind us. It's clear that the virus is lasting much longer than we all hoped it would if we were to have spoken about this back in March or April. And it's equally clear that the speed at which vaccines have been developed has surprised a lot of people. And we're starting to see some light at the end of the tunnel, even if the remaining bit of the tunnel is still long. And while the economic fallout has no doubt been significant, you know, we've not seen a crash in global markets, for example, and asset prices have continued to hold up and corporate balance sheets are relatively strong. And so there's good news among the bad news. I think that our more pessimistic scenario would have demand not recovering until 2024. And if you were to double click on that, you'd see a much faster recovery for leisure traffic than you would see for business traffic, where businesses, even if they're financially healthy, have all learned that technologies like Teams and Zoom and WebEx are working relatively well and can replace some of the travel that they used to do and will likely replace that travel in the future. The more optimistic scenario might have us back to normal, you know, or at least to 2019 volumes, you know, by the end of 2022. And I'd say we're starting to have the window close on the likelihood of that scenario. That would require that by the fall of this coming year, 2021, we're well into vaccine distribution. The one caveat I would make is that in this industry, you can't have more passengers than you have seats. And this is an industry where we make relatively important decisions about capacity with long lead times. You can't snap your fingers and bring back planes that you've parked in the desert or recall furloughed pilots. It takes time. So it may well be that even if demand comes back sooner, we don't see the volumes until well into 2023, simply because the industry isn't yet prepared to accept those passengers.
Robin, I'm very aware of the fact that this has been such a painful period for the industry. You're both out there in the front lines talking to executives, employees, engineers, et cetera. Can you give us some sense as to just what people have been doing to cope, to just survive this?
It's a really challenging time, of course, for the executives of these companies, but also the employees. And you know, I've been heartened by many of the actions we've seen where companies really have stepped forward to try to protect jobs as much as they could, and where employees and, you know, their unions have leaned forward to find creative arrangements that will protect jobs, help the companies survive, and, you know, work much more hand in hand than they have in the past. And so there have been a number of deals that will reduce, let's say, flying hours for individual pilots, but keep the overall number of pilots at a higher level, therefore. Or, you know, reduce certain compensation packages for the short term so that the financials work out in these difficult times. So that has been hard to see. At the same time, we've seen massive layoffs despite all of that, right? And particularly on the pilot side, it's a challenging situation because as a pilot, you need to remain certified and stay in the role, so to speak, to feel comfortable flying. And many pilots that have been laid off now don't really have an opportunity to go somewhere else to fly. They're probably going to spend a year, two, three not flying before they get recalled. And so by then, they might have switched into another industry. They might feel that they have really lost the skill and need significant training to come back to flying. And there's a good chance that that will actually cause what we would consider a pilot shortage in a couple of years, simply because there's enough people leaving the industry as a result of all of this.
You know, Alex, you mentioned the shift even between the ratio of leisure to business. Airlines are constantly innovating on that front. I remember talking to somebody at Cathay once even about how they place the bathrooms and how many bathrooms they have in different flights, depending on how much beer people drink, et cetera. I mean, there are a lot of long-term planning, a lot of innovation that they've been looking at. How is this shifting the focus of even just the investments that these airlines are making, both now and in anticipation of a recovery?
Sure. There are a number of changes. I think on the investment front, it really depends on what kind of airline you are. Certainly, there are airlines whose hubs are in cities with enormous volumes of high-end business traffic. The banking sector, the consulting sector, the legal sector, these people historically have flown a lot, and they typically fly in the front end of the cabin. And so, you know, you would see airlines for whom they might have aircraft where the number of business class seats could exceed the number of economy class seats. And I think many of those companies will struggle to fill those cabins in a post-COVID world at first, and we will see a shift in thinking about that. That said, over the last several years, one of the biggest growth segments that we've seen has been, you know, high-end leisure. And, you know, these are not necessarily very wealthy people, but people who see travel as their most important use of their disposable income and are willing to splurge for a better experience. And so if you looked across business class cabins in many airlines over the past few years, certainly you would have seen a number of people with loosened ties and their laptops out, but you'd also see couples clinking their champagne glasses and families and honeymooners and retirees. And that will be a really important segment post-COVID. And there, while 100 business class seats in some cases may be too much for that segment, 50 certainly isn't. And the corporate market tends to pay very high prices, and they tend to book relatively late. It wouldn't be unusual to look at a flight between London and New York a month out and see that the seat map is two-thirds empty, only to find it relatively full on the day of departure. Leisure passengers tend to book earlier, and historically, airlines have held back on the number of leisure passengers that they would allow into those seats, waiting for corporate travelers to show up. So we may see a shift in that dynamic, where we allow more seats to be sold earlier, perhaps at lower prices. With that might come a shift towards point-to-point traffic, people who are actually going between London and New York, versus people who are connecting over London, from another market. All of that will result in likely lower average revenues, but it doesn't have to result in dramatically lower average revenues.
Robin, I've been looking at, obviously not taking them, but seat sales to Miami from New York, for example, for $60 round trip. It does feel like it's going to be hard to wean people off some of these extremely low fares that, frankly, we've become addicted to in the past few years, even prior to the pandemic. What do you see there in terms of pricing power, as Alex mentioned?
Yeah, it's a good observation. I think on the pricing side, the challenge we're having is that the systems that manage pricing, revenue management system, the pricing systems, in many cases rely on past information and past data. And past information is not that helpful right now to figure out what passengers really want or what people are willing to pay. What we're finding with our clients is that customers are much less elastic than they were before. Before, you could throw out a very low fare and people would flock to it, where right now, it's not necessarily the fare that makes people travel or hold them back, but it's the fear of getting infected or the fear of being away from home and the door shutting on them. So pricing is a very challenging topic right now, where there's very little precedence we can rely on. Now, that being said, I think airlines are making some progress in using what we would call non-traditional data sources and really trying to understand what drives willingness to pay and what are customers really looking for and willing to pay for in this new scenario. And so looking at search trends, looking at customer sentiments, looking at how people search across a website, all of those kind of things are starting to flow into the revenue management systems and will hopefully help us manage prices back up to a more sustainable level instead of lowering them, trying to stimulate traffic that is really not that stimulatable right now.
Alex, I know that you've done a lot of work in this with McKinsey regarding sustainability, and COVID's almost distracted us, although not quite, from what a terrible year 2020 was. I think it was on record as the hottest year on record. We keep setting these every year. And the airline industry has been front and center, both as an emitter of greenhouse gas emissions, but also an innovator on that front. Has COVID sort of shifted the ability or even the focus of the industry on these issues?
Yes and no. I don't know a single CEO who believes that sustainability is not coming back onto the agenda as a critical topic. It is something that our corporate clients are demanding, and our corporate clients are demanding it because their employees and their customers are demanding it of them. And the good news is those who are working on technology innovation, the development of sustainable aviation fuels, the use of hydrogen, electrification, they've been working around the clock and haven't taken any time off.
Yeah, maybe if I can add to that.
Oh, please.
There's almost not a week right now where we're not meeting with senior executives in the industry talking about sustainability. And I'm actually both surprised but excited about the fact that that is happening, and that COVID has not made this a second order item, but it's actually still on the top of the agenda for many of the industry executives. We see airlines all over the world wondering what to do, and some working with offsets, some working by buying sustainable aviation fuel and trying to spur that industry, some investing in future technology for propulsion, whether it's electric or hydrogen combustion or similar technologies. And we're seeing an influx of investment in that sector.
I want to pick up on that a bit, Robin and Alex weigh in too, because there was so much excitement even around, you know, personalized air travel. I mean, it feels like, are those conversations really taking a back seat to recovery, or are we still seeing even the investments in AI and some of the other areas that might just advance air travel beyond where we are today?
I think we'll have to separate here these future models, which are shorter distance, and you know, some people would refer to them as flying cars equivalent. So really smaller aircraft that fly, let's say, up to 300 or 500 miles. And that is a new industry, and it's driven by a number of major trends. One trend being electrification and battery density, and getting to a point where it becomes technically feasible to have vehicles that operate that way. And then, you know, the drive for more sustainability, the advance of AI and data that makes some of this more effective. And then last but not least, also the interest of the customer to look at mobility as a service, to no longer just own a car and drive everywhere, but, you know, to hail a ride share, or to, you know, look at sharing different modes. And so you take all of these things together, creates a really fertile environment for a new mode of air transportation. And you know, we track over 250 companies out there who are trying to play in the space. There's probably about a dozen or so of them which have significant funding and size by now. And we see a number of prototypes flying around, and there's you know, real expectations in the next 3 to 4 years, we will see the first commercial models of these arrive in our cities. And what form that will take, whether it's going to be helicopter-like from one rooftop to the other, or whether it's more of a regional model that uses airports or airport-like infrastructure to, you know, go from one city to another, is to be seen. All of these have some promise, but yeah, the devil is going to be in the execution and the detail, but it surely is an exciting time for that space.
You mentioned earlier what's happening in China and Asia. How is that picture, you think, changing, especially in a part of the world where air travel is more back to normal?
Over the short and medium term, we see some clear shifts. I think one is that right now, what little traffic there is in much of the world is leisure traffic. One of the big changes there is that if you're going to a city that is difficult to get to, whether or not there's one flight a day or one flight every 3 days or five flights a day really doesn't change the fact that you need to go. And so we're seeing a bias towards fewer flights and typically larger aircraft. You know, get as many people as you can on each one of your relatively few flights. The other reason, of course, for that is that there is cargo demand, and larger aircraft do a better job of accommodating cargo than do smaller aircraft. I'd say the other sort of unfortunate fact relative to our conversation about sustainability is that in a world where there's very little demand and fuel prices are relatively low, all of the things being equal, many airlines would say that if they could wave a magic wand, they'd sort of put their newer, expensive aircraft off into the future and make use of the cheap, older aircraft that burn a bit more fuel today. That said, as we look forward, I think we'll see airlines looking for more fuel-efficient aircraft. They'll be looking for aircraft with more customer-friendly features like Wi-Fi and, you know, upgraded business-class cabins and bigger overhead bins. And the interest in 100-seat aircraft that was there before will exist for some of the same reasons that was the case before COVID. Those aircraft are very useful at filling in city pairs that demand a lower cost structure that can be achieved with a 50- or a 70-seat aircraft, but don't need 140 or 150 seats in order to achieve reasonable load factors. So I don't expect that to change. I'd say the only thing that the industry expects to change is the amount of global investment in long-haul wide-body capacity. And the reason for that is pre-COVID, many of the world's airplanes that were flying on long-haul routes were losing money. And they were losing money because they were flown by relatively small airlines, in many cases backed by states, whose objectives went beyond profit. It was important to have these routes for political reasons, for pride, national sovereignty, in some cases, you know, thoughtful links to economic development. But many governments are coming back around and saying, look, we've got a lot of priorities for a stretched state's treasury as it is today. And you know, we're not going to be able to keep funding loss-making operations forever. And we're seeing more and more governments asking their state-linked airlines to come up with plans that enable them to be financially sustainable. And in many cases, that will mean smaller long-haul networks with fewer aircrafts, good for carbon emissions, you know, probably not great for long-haul ticket prices.
That makes sense. Let me ask on a personal level, I know you're both must be road warriors who were also had your plans and travel put on hold. I'm personally very eager to get back on a plane again. And you mentioned earlier, Alex and Robin as well, just about Zoom calls and this pressure on corporate travel basically being held back. I'd love to hear from both of you personally. Is that something that you welcome? I mean, how much were you traveling prior to the pandemic? Robin, let me start with you.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mixed bag. I mean, on the one hand, you know, I'm glad to be home more right now. You know, we have a 18-month-old infant in the house, and it's just fantastic to be between meetings or in the end of the day, be able to see my son. And so I appreciate not being on the road all the time anymore. At the same time, I truly miss seeing my clients and my friends and my family. I just did the math the other day, and this is the longest I've gone without seeing my parents in my life. I've seen them basically not in the last year, in the last 12 months. And so that weighs heavy on me. And so, yeah, there's some positive and some negative in the lack of travel right now, for sure.
What about for you, Alex?
Sure. Well, first of all, prior to COVID, I was traveling more than virtually anyone that I've ever met. Typically, I would be in three continents in a week. I sleep well on planes. My pattern would be I would get on a plane at night. I'd go to sleep. I'd wake up in another continent. I'd have a full day of meetings. I'd get on another plane that night, go to sleep, wake up in another continent, and end up back at home, you know, Thursday night or Friday morning. And that allowed me to cover a lot of ground, see a lot of people, and do so in a way that was relatively sustainable from a lifestyle standpoint. Remember, I sleep well on planes, so I got as much sleep on the plane as I would typically get at home, some cases more. That has changed dramatically. I have been on a few flights, particularly on the long haul. And by the way, as an aside, you know, some of the conversations I've had with crew have really been sort of touching. I was on a flight between the US and London with eight passengers on board, and the crew were practically in tears. It was their first flight in months, and they understand very well that without passengers, they don't have a future. And so I certainly hope for their sake that we see as much of the demand coming back as possible. I, like Robin, I see some benefits to this. Certainly, I find interacting with my colleagues, whom I know well, to be much more efficient via these kinds of technologies. I don't need to read their body language. I want to see them on some cycle, but we can get a lot done very quickly. I also find that the fact that nobody is traveling means that calendars are much less rigid. If I want to get a client together with me for a discussion, I usually find an hour within a couple of days. And I think in the old world, we'd often go back and forth for a couple of weeks trying to match up calendars and find a time where we could both be in the same spot on the globe when neither of us were someplace else. And so that will be something that I don't want to give up. And at the same time, like Robin, I am in this business because I want to help people, and I like people, and I like getting to know my clients on a personal level. And that is hard to do via Zoom. And I think for me, I will do a lot less internal travel. I will replace some of that space with more client travel. And the other thing that I've noted, and I've heard others say the same, is that while in the future, I may need to see in person everyone in my personal network less frequently, because you know every two out of three interactions we can do remotely, I'm also meeting more people. In the last 8 months, I have met, in inverted commas, more people than I have ever met in any eight-month period in my life, because it is so easy to connect with people. And so each one of those people I want to see in person at some point. And so I wouldn't be surprised if a couple of years from now you find me doing pretty much as much travel as I was doing before, but perhaps getting more out of it.
That's interesting. Well, as we finish up here, to those in the industry who are listening, any advice that you might have? I'm going to start with you, Robin.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things worth keeping top of mind here. I think for one, making sure to understand what are the relative risks and what does the latest research show about, you know, what is considered safe or what is relatively safe versus what is risky behavior. And so even within travel, I think now with many studies that have been done, there's enough evidence that air travel is relatively safe and you can protect yourself with few measures. I think the second thing is to really think through what is essential travel and how do you define that and give guidance to your organizations. You know, the question is going to be, how do you roll back up into travel? Do you just go back to where you were before, or do you adjust your travel policy and make some adjustments for things like safety, but also things like the environment and adjustments for how we've learned now all to work with modern technology to avoid some of the travel?
Alex, anything you'd want to add to the industry leaders' thoughts?
Yeah, I would say a few things in addition to what Robin has said. I think one is everyone needs to be prepared for, you know, a two-speed recovery or return over the course of the next 12 months. And what I mean by that is, while we have a reasonable degree of confidence of where things are going to be in, let's say, 2024 or 2025, none of us really know how the summer is going to play out. And we could find that demand is coming back much more quickly, and we could find that we're in for another 6 to 8 months of this. And so that's a very hard planning position to be in, to be ready for, you know, a significant contraction or a significant expansion of operations. And I think, ironically, the expansion may prove to be more complicated. When demand falls off, your reduction in capacity trails the fall off in demand, almost by definition. You see that there are fewer people on planes, you reduce flights. As you reduce flights, you reduce pilots. You get the idea. When demand comes back very quickly, by definition, it will come back faster than you can bring capacity on board. And so at a time where airlines are going to be looking for as much goodwill as they can get from governments, labor unions, and their passengers, there's a very high risk that we'll see long queues in airports, lots of delays, canceled flights, simply because we're not ready for the demand that appears. And I wish I had a better answer as to which one to prepare for, but I think we need to be ready for both. I think the other thought that I would leave airline executives with, and this is a longer term thought, it's I hope that 5 years from now, you know, everyone will still be talking about COVID agility. And what I mean by that is the speed at which we were able to get difficult things done during COVID. The airline industry will end up playing a significant role in distributing those vaccines and will have put in place the infrastructure to do so in record times. Many airlines have moved to a world where what used to be 8-week, 12-week planning cycles are now done in 1 to 2 weeks. And we've impressed ourselves. And my hope is that we retain some of those learnings and maybe move to a world where we stop telling ourselves that every major innovation needs to, by definition, take several years to implement. And we start acting a little bit, you know, more like digital leaders who tend to get things done quite quickly in a sort of trial and error kind of way. And of course, I'm speaking more about the commercial side than I am about operations, where safety is paramount in our industry. But I think there are many positive lessons to be learned, and I hope we hang on to several of them.
Can you give me some sense as to sort of just what's on your radar and what you're watching over the next year in general with regard to the industry? Clearly, COVID is one big factor, but anything else that you would like the audience to be looking at and thinking about?
I think there's probably 4 or 5 different themes here that are becoming important into 2021 beyond COVID. I think on the one hand, it's sustainability. We need to get more serious and find better ways to abate some of the carbon we're producing. I think a second theme will be what we call kind of the future of air mobility, or the eVTOL space, or advanced air mobility space. Another theme we haven't talked about is cargo transportation by drone. I mean, we're seeing a broad number of trials around the world where vaccinations or blood transfusions, you know, or now even medication and e-commerce packages are transported by drones over the short range or over the long range for the last mile. And then the more traditional airlines, I think customer experience is going to be one to watch. I think as we come through COVID, airlines, or at least the smart airlines, will take this as an opportunity to make things not just safer, but also better. So whether that is self-service at the airport, whether it's some of the digital offerings they have, whether it's onboard product, we're seeing a number of changes coming that'll make travel better in the future.
Alex, what would be on your radar for people to watch over the next year?
Well, I'm hopeful that we'll see a couple of things. I think one is that we'll start to move from a world where the industry is focused on survival to a world where at least parts of the industry are focused on, you know, long-term success. Let's recognize that this is an industry that for the better part of its 75 plus year existence has not made a dime. And part of that has to do with a very challenging structure. Too many airlines, outdated regulations, very powerful supply chains in many cases. And the banks, as they emerged from the global financial crisis, certainly asked for help from governments, but also took the opportunity to engage stakeholders and regulators in a conversation around how to create a healthier and more stable industry going forward. And I think for the most part, that's worked. So I'm looking forward to that. And then second, and I alluded to this before as we talked about agility, I'm looking forward to some of the innovations that will naturally come out of this. I think several of the changes that the industry has put in place during COVID, particularly moving from physical touch points to digital touch points, are hugely relevant because digital technologies allow people a sense of control and transparency that I think everyone wants. And I'm looking forward as a passenger to some of those changes.
Much fodder. If you'd like to hear more, please do go to McKinsey.com. We've been speaking with Alex Dichter and Robin Riedel. Alex and Robin, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Diane. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Diane.
You've been listening to the McKinsey podcast. To learn more about McKinsey, our people, and our latest thinking, visit us at McKinsey.com or find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook.